fall over anything over here. Okay, we'll try this one now. All right, so we're kind of covering now, this, since it's only parents at this time, and earlier we had the students with us. What I'm going to be talking about now is more some of the earlier stuff in my book, in this red book, if you have it, called Preparing Your Teens for College, preparing them for college, preparing them for adulthood, preparing them for life. Cover some of the stuff that's talked about in the early chapters in that book. This guy's off now. Yeah, okay, now it's, whoops, I went to, back to this one. Okay, there we, oh. There we go. Okay. All right, here we go. So there's six areas covered in my book, and there's six, those are the six sections that you'll see in the table of contents: character, faith, relationships, academics, finances, and the college decision. Okay, so we talked, kind of already talked about faith and relationships last night, and then kind of academics and the college decision this morning in the earlier session. So what I'm going to talk about now is character and finances in particular. And so this kind of picture is sort of an illustration of what often happens. You know, the kids going to school that first day, and we don't want them to grow up. And then they're going off to college, and we don't want them to grow up, right? The kid doesn't want to go, then we don't want them to go. So as the children grow up, it's a process in which we're losing control, okay? And this can be very destabilizing as parents to see that our kids are becoming their own people, their own will, their own mind, their own interests, their own talents are all coming to bear. So they're starting them to go to college, and we're afraid of the loss of control that we have in their lives. And there's two poor responses to make in light of this. Underparenting and overparenting. Okay, and these are discussed in the book in more detail, and here's what I mean by that. We'll unpack them a bit here. Underparenting is very common among non-Christian parents, I think, in our day, and it's sort of a failure to do the parental job. It's an acting like a teen with your teen. We see in our culture the glorification of youth, of all that goes with being young. There have been movies made where adult men act like teenage boys, and this is laughed about and kind of glorified, and yeah, play and be responsible for as long as possible. The average video game consumer in our day is actually in their low 30s years old. We think teens play too many video games, but actually the purchase of video games among 20-year-olds and 30-year-olds is all-time high, more than teens. So there's a lot of money to be made by marketing products to irresponsible 20-somethings and to keep people being as young and irresponsible as possible is very profitable for a lot of companies. So a lot of what's being marketed, movies, games, vacations, is being marketed at this kind of demographic of 18 to 35-year-old men who have a lot of discretionary income and don't have a lot of responsibilities. And so underparenting kind of is the reaction to that among non-Christian parents. So just go with the flow. Act like a teen so that you can be cool like your teen. I read a letter in a newspaper from a dad who was complaining about his wife starting to act like a teenage girl again because she was trying to bond with her daughter who was 14 years old, and the mom was going out and getting new clothes and kind of acting differently, trying to fit in with the daughter, and thinking, if I don't do that, I'll lose my daughter. She won't want to be around an old parent like me. And so we kind of, it's a fear. I mentioned this earlier in my morning session that some teachers are afraid of their students and they try to lower their expectations to kind of be cool and be the teacher who's not too mean or too hard. And this is kind of the parenting version of that, where you want to please your kids all the time. They're the center of your world. And you send the message that taking on responsibilities is a burden to be avoided as long as possible. Being young is cool. Being adult is a drag. And those who take this view aren't training their kids. They're not teaching them. They're not mentoring them. They're not preparing them for adult responsibilities. All they're doing is delaying adult responsibilities. And we can't abdicate our God-given role. God put us in the life of our teens to train them for adulthood. We're uniquely positioned to guide them in that process. So then the next mistake, that one is probably less common in this audience, I would imagine that danger is less common. But the other danger is over-parenting. And this is sometimes referred to as helicopter parenting. This is more common among Christians, especially the more we care about our kids, the more we have this danger of hovering over them and micromanaging their decisions. And when we do that, the danger is that we're grasping for control, we're fighting against nature. Okay, the way God has made the world is for our kids in their early years to be like that mom on the left. I have young kids in my home, and I kind of like them being young. It is fun for them to be young, right? We have control of their life when they're young. We can give them, I say, you know, do you want to go swimming class? I'll get you a swimming class, and we can control it, and we can kind of, you know, have control over their activities academically, extracurricularly. The older they get, the harder it is to retain that, and this overparenting view is trying to fight to retain that control. It's treating 15-year-olds like they're 10-year-olds. There's a big difference. Even though for us, it's like 5 years just went by like that. But for them, that's that's the third of their life that just changed. And they changed massively. Hormones, puberty, all that changed them. Their brain's different. And we can't fight to treat them like they're kids. We can't fight to retain control because that control is going away one way or the other. So whether we like it or not, the day is coming when they're going to be on their own and they're going to be able to do things that flow out of their own. I don't even need this, do I? They're going to be able to do things that they want to do, whether we like it or not. What we need to do instead is train them, is shepherd them, is mentor them to make choices that flow out of their own wisdom that God has given them. If we overparent, we send the message that you're incapable of handling life. Okay, I have seen college students. My writing this book was kind of, I was asked to write this book, and I had the idea to write this book from thinking about what would I like to see parents do for their kids before they come to my college classes. I have seen college students who grew up in overparenting homes, and what I see is 18-year-olds who don't have the skills of that 15-year-olds used to have. 18-year-olds who don't know how to check their own homework because when I ask them, they say, well, my mom did that for me. And my mom's not here anymore, and so now I don't have anyone to do it for me. And their mom never taught them to do it themselves. So it's okay to check your kids' homework when they're 10 years old, but as they get 15, 16, 17, they should be learning to check that for themselves. Otherwise, we send the message that they're incapable. If we do everything for our teenagers, what do they learn? They learn that I can't do it myself. Mom and dad can do it for me. That's all my only hope. Call mom and dad. It's a funny story that I'll tell you. I was in unfortunately, I was in a car accident when I was in college, and no one was hurt. It was my fault, but no one was hurt. But I was all by myself. It was an icy road condition, and I had to just get out and, you know, walk to a payphone. No, didn't have a cell phone. Walk to a payphone. Hey, can you help me out? You know, get in a tow truck and all that stuff, and then rent a car to get to where I was going. I had to make a lot of decisions on the fly to kind of bail myself out. I was 20 years old, and it was at the time I had to do all this stuff myself. No one's going to do this for me. I had to just figure it out and do it. I went to college 10 hours away from my family in Chicago. I was in the college in New York where the accident happened. Three, 4 years ago, I was in another car accident. This time it was the other person's fault. She went sideways on a freeway and hit me because I was going the right way and she was going sideways. It was a college girl, and she was okay. I was okay. I was on one side of the road. She was on the other side of the road. So I'm calling AAA and stuff like that. She's on the phone for a long time, and she's crying. She's on the phone, and I'm wondering. She just looked okay. She didn't look hurt. Coming to find out, she was on the phone with her mom, describing everything that happened, asking her mom exactly what she ought to do now. And that makes sense. She's 20 years old. She's distraught. She had panicked and gone this way on the freeway. But it occurred to me that what cell phones have made it easier for kids not to have to do things that we used to have to do, that you used to have to do, right? Now a lot of teens we it used to be that when we grew up, we sent our teens out. We said, okay, if you get, remember, if you get, thank you. Remember, if you have a trouble, you can always do this or that. Figure it out. When my wife was in high school, she once got lost driving somewhere, and she had to just figure out where she was and where she was going. Now you can just make a phone call, which of course is good for safety. But the flip side is, do we maybe sometimes go too far and have our kids just know, okay, if I get in trouble, I just call. And someone else will think for me. Someone else will decide for me. Someone else will exercise the wisdom that my parents exercised at my age because they had to. So just something to think about. I'm all for safety. I'm glad that girl had her cell phone to call her mom. That's great. But sometimes I wonder, have we gone too far? And are kids not able to process things themselves? We need to teach our teens to exercise sound judgment, to look at a situation. Maybe they have incomplete information, but to make the best decision they can and to live with the consequences. Because if they make small mistakes now in your home, you can help them process that. When they leave the home, if they don't have the decision-making skills, they're going to make bigger mistakes outside the home. So it's a scary thing. And I'm not saying that we let our kids make every decision they want. We have to protect them from making harmful decisions that have long-term consequences. But there's a difference between decisions that are short-term that have small consequences and decisions that are long-term that have bigger consequences. Dropping out of high school is a terrible decision that would have long-term consequences. Buying an expensive item that maybe is frivolous, and you know it's frivolous, but they don't know it's frivolous. You know it's going to be sitting in their desk for another 3 years. It's never going to get used. That decision that they make is foolish, but that could teach them. I have a friend who was a pastor who remembers when he was 14 years old spending all his money on a mini disc. Does anyone know what a mini disc is? Came out right before the iPods. So mini discs came out, then came the iPods, then came the iPhones. So he bought a mini disc. It was different technology than the iPod. And he spent all his money on it. It was just so cool. He was 14 years old. I have a mini disc. It's great. And a year later, the iPod came out, and everyone was having the iPods, and he had the mini disc. And then he felt silly. And he says, since that day, I've never been the guy who goes out and spends all his money buying that new thing. Because I learned my lesson when I was in high school. And he told his parents about it. His parents said, we knew that was a bad decision. But it was not a sinful decision, but it was foolish. But we didn't want to prevent you from doing it because it would teach you a lesson about money management. So that's a decision that I think has short-term negative consequences. So you buy a mini disc, it sits around in your desk drawer, never gets used, you wasted your money. That's bad. But it's short-term bad. You know what I mean? You know what I mean by that? It didn't hurt him long-term. I have other friends who've allowed their 13-year-olds to buy skateboards that are crazy expensive. The kid doesn't even know how to skateboard. He wants to just go buy the most expensive skateboard. So that's a way to learn. You talk to him. You try to say, well, think about the pros and cons here. Is this really a good purchase? Is this a bad purchase? You help them assess it. But are there ways you can give your teens a measure of freedom and responsibility and authority so that they can practice what it means to be responsible? And yes, they're going to make a few mistakes here and there, but you can shepherd them through those mistakes and therefore I give them the strength to make long-term decisions that are good and wise later. Do your teens need to start carrying the burden for doing their own homework without being prompted? Is it appropriate for your teens to pay for some of their own clothing or to prepare dinner once in a while or do their own or do the family's laundry once in a while? By the same token, should your teens at some age have some more input in determining their curfew if they can be responsible? Should they have the decision of whether they invest more time in the piano or getting a job that might help them with a college major decision later on? So are there ways as your teens get older that you can give them opportunities to demonstrate more freedom and to understand that with more freedom comes more responsibility? As they begin to mature, look for ways to give them freedom and responsibility, because if you don't, you'll stifle their development. The way God has designed it is for us to grow into adulthood in those teen years. There's a verse in Hebrews 5:14 reads this way: solid food is for the mature, for those who have their powers of discernment trained by constant practice to distinguish good from evil. So what he's talking about in this passage in Hebrews 5 is how some of them ought to be teachers. That's what he was saying in Hebrews 5, but they're still children. He's calling them children in the faith, but saying you should be teachers by now. And then he has this sentence saying, solid food is for the mature, and one of the distinguishing features of a mature person is how discerning they are. And that discernment comes by training. Training means practice. So if your child is making the first decisions for themselves when they're 300 miles away from your home, imagine how scary that's going to be. If you've made all the decisions for them all their life, and they go off to college somewhere 300 miles away, and then for the first time they're trying to decide big things in life, maybe they're faced with temptations of alcohol or sexual immorality, and they haven't been trained to handle those situations, that will not be a good thing for them. I would rather have my teens, as young adults, start to spread their wings when they're still in my home. That way I can teach them how to fly and they're not flopping around 400 miles away in college. So it's a judgment call. And every kid's going to be different. Some kids are going to do it better than others. Some kids are going to make more mistakes than others. And I'm not saying we give them full autonomy when they're in our home. We still are the heads of our homes. We still are in charge in our home. But it's a matter of how can we view them as an adult in training and not as a child. If you treat your 16-year-old like a child, they'll act like a child. And when they leave your home, they'll probably do whatever they wanted to do all along that you were preventing them from doing. So train their hearts, shepherd their hearts, because out of their heart will ultimately flow their own decisions. Okay, so what should we do? Besides pray for our teens. Pray that God would own their hearts. Pray that they would be devoted to the things of God. Pray that they would walk on the paths that you've taught them. But besides that, we aim for moral authority and influence. And here's what I mean by that. Positional authority is not the same as moral authority. Okay? Positional authority is what you have as their mom and dad. You have the authority. No one questions it. Your teen doesn't question that. I guarantee your 17-year-old knows you're in charge. Okay? Moral authority is a little bit different. Moral authority is ultimately stronger than positional authority. Moral authority is your teen knows that you love them and have their best interest at heart. So I learned this as a professor early on when I started teaching. The students in my class knew that I was in charge. I was the professor. But unless they believed that I cared about them, they wouldn't do what I needed them to do to be successful. So I said, you need to study this much every week. You need to do these homework problems to be successful. But unless they believed me, they wouldn't actually do it. I was in charge, but I didn't have the ability to make it happen. What I wanted to have happen, I couldn't make happen. And parenting teens is somewhat similar, because what you want to have happen is you want them to start choosing the right things for the right reasons on their own. You want them to start independent of you. You want them choosing to follow Jesus and obey Jesus in the way they live out their homework, their academics, their social life, and etc. You want them to start doing that on their own, yet you can't make that happen. They have to do that in response to God ultimately. Moral authority means they know that you have their best interest in mind. Moral authority is they trust you. They see you as a friend and a mentor and a guide, and they value what you say. Okay, so that's why I spend the first couple of days of my semester convincing students that I have their best interest in mind, that it's in their interest to work hard, and that I am their coach helping them to be successful. What am I doing? I'm trying to go for moral authority. I'm trying to build in their life a sense of trust and influence. Ultimately, moral authority is what gives you influence where it counts, influence at their heart level. At their heart level. You want to be influencing them at their heart level. And that comes when they trust you. And they trust you when they know that you have their best interest in mind. Influence is what we want to be gaining as we're losing control. Okay? So as you lose control in the teen years, what you want to be gaining is influence. And you gain influence by having moral authority. And you have moral authority when you have conversations with your teens and where you model the Christian faith to your teens, and you model how you, as a parent, are living in accordance with God's will in your work, in your home, in your responsibilities, and you're modeling that for them, and you're helping them see, hey, this is good for you too. You need to do this too because it's good for you. So it's not son, daughter, obey me, because if you don't obey me, I look stupid at church and people make fun of me. It's son or daughter, obey what I'm saying because it's going to be good for you. We see this language in Proverbs all over the place where the Proverbs talk about, my son, if you receive my instruction, this will go well for you. This will be good for you. You want to avoid destruction. You want to avoid shame. Do the right things. Obey me because I love you, because I have the best interest in his heart for you. So appealing to their self-interest is relevant, is important. Obeying God is the best way to have a happy and fulfilled life. The commands of God are not given to remove our joy, but to enhance our joy. Helping your teens be convinced that you have their interest in mind, that the Bible has their interest in mind, that saying no to the temptations of sin, even though they're alluring, even though they offer an immediate thrill, that God has better pleasures for me, God has greater delights for me, that I can say no to something today because God's got something better for me tomorrow, that's what you want to get after. Because then they will be choosing the right thing for the right reasons, even when they're living 200 miles away from your home. This is from Ted Tripp's book, Shepherding a Child's Heart, and Ted wrote the foreword for my book, and he's been very influential in the way I think about a young adult development. And so he had this idea about influence going up as positional authority goes down. What I'm adding to that discussion is the influence goes up when you have the moral authority. When they see that you are not a hypocrite, when they see that you are authentic, then you have the influence. The character and maturity that I'm talking, what I'm talking about here really is character and maturity. Developing your children to see themselves as young adults, treating them as young adults, and then expecting them to act like young adults. That character and maturity that we want from our teens, it most readily flows from relationship with Jesus Christ, from being born again by the Holy Spirit. That's where it most readily flows, because a good tree bears good fruit. Right? But that's ultimately something that each of our teens is different in terms of when they get saved. And it may be that your 13-year-old is not yet a Christian, okay? And if they are, what do you do then? Well, you can still train their character, teach them, model, shepherd, train, while you remind them of their need for Jesus. You can do those side by side, because whether or not our children come to faith when we hope they come to faith, our job is to prepare them to live wisely. So we can train them in God's ways, but we got to keep reminding them that you need to be born again. You need Jesus to help you live God's ways. But this is the right way to live. But simply doing things isn't going to save you. So I'm not saying that obedience is itself the goal. The goal is obedience from a changed heart. Our goal is for God to change their heart, to save them from their sin, and the obedience that we long for flows from a changed life. But whether or not that happens, we still have a duty to train them for responsible living. That's why my book is not just about helping them become a Christian, helping them grow in a Christian. My book is about helping them grow in their faith, but also apply that faith in their academics and every other area of their life, because wise living is useful for them, and it's our job to prepare them for life, even if maybe God saves them when they're in college. That happens in some cases. But our management of our home, our training of them in our home, is what God used to save them, but they did it later. And I've seen that happen in many, many instances. Okay. So shape their character. How do we want to do this? A couple of thoughts on that. Cultivating responsibility, okay? When they fall short, help them to assess what happened, cause and effect, reaping what you sow. It seems so simple to us, but it's hard to learn, okay? I think Galatians 6 talks about reaping what you sow in a later season. And sometimes you reap more than what you sowed. A bad decision can reap bad consequences. We need to help our teens realize that. And we need to not shield them from negative consequences. Take initiative, teaching them to take initiative for themselves, to encouraging them to, hey, go find a part-time job, go find a summer class, go take advantage of opportunities that you have out there and take the bull by the horns and run with it. You can do it. We encourage you. We're behind you. We're with you. You need to do it yourself. Helping them to start doing that for themselves instead of always being us the ones who are doing it for them. Encourage them to be lifelong learners, to keep on learning. Faithfulness today leads to larger responsibilities later. Help them that, you know, when your homework is boring and you don't really want to do it and it's kind of a drag, you know what? That's life sometimes. But be faithful in little things because that'll prepare you for bigger things later on. Small things provide a safe place for them to fail and grow, which prepares them for the future. I mentioned that a bit earlier as well. Okay, future orientation. Delaying gratification is crucial, okay? Being willing to deny an immediate and not necessarily sinful pleasure to achieve something later and something greater. That's important. Teens need to learn to do something they don't want to do right now so that they can become something that they want to become later. Everyone who's successful has learned that, okay? Football players, musicians, academicians, professionals, they've learned that you sometimes have to do what you don't want to do so you can become what you want to become. When you prepare for a test when you'd rather be playing, when you prepare for a recital by practicing your instrument every day, when you prepare for a competition in sports, what are you doing? You're delaying gratification. You're doing what you don't want to do right now so that you can accomplish something later. No successful person always does what they want to do in the moment. Okay, sometimes I think young adults have this idea that it's authentic to do whatever you want. It's just being real. It's just, I don't want to do this right now, so I'm not going to do it. I'm going to follow my heart. The Walt Disney mentality of just follow your heart. But your heart will lead you into bad places because your heart is easily deceived, right? Jeremiah 17:9, your heart's deceptive and wicked. Who can understand it? So no successful person always does what they want to do. Every successful person controls their desires and says no to some of their desires so that they can say yes to other desires. This requires having a vision for the teen years. Vision for teen life. The popular culture in our day, I mentioned this a moment ago, tells us that teens are slaves to their passions and inherently irresponsible. It's about once a year that Time magazine will run a cover story on the teen brain. Ever seen a story like that in a magazine? Every year they keep doing the same thing. And they say, well, you know, brain science tells us that teens' brains are not yet fully developed. They're still growing. They're still changing. So we can't expect them to act responsibly until they're much older. And that's why they're so impetuous and so irresponsible and careless, and we just have to deal with it. Here's the problem with that research. First of all, the historical view does nothing like that, okay? I know this picture is kind of... just looks kind of, maybe it's kind of not the best picture, but oh well. Teenagers are young adults in the making. That's the biblical view. And that's actually the historical view as well. Until about the last 80 years, teens were expected to act like young adults at 13, 14, 15. It doesn't mean that they're mature adults. They're young adults. They're growing. They're adults in apprentice training years. What that means is that we expect them to begin to act like adults. Teens used to spend more time with adults and used to have less difficulty entering adulthood. Today, teens spend almost all their time with other teens and very little time with the adults whom they're supposedly becoming. And that's why they have such difficulty entering adulthood, because they'd have so little in the way of training and modeling of what it means to be an adult. The example of David in the Bible, I think, is instructive. When David... in the David and Goliath story, we often miss this element. David told Saul, when David went down to see how his brothers were doing, and the Goliath was challenging them to a duel, and he was saying, "Send me your best man, and I'll fight your best man." And then David said this, "Your servant used to keep sheep for his father. And when there came a lion or a bear and took a lamb from the flock, I went after him, and I struck him and delivered it out of his mouth. And if he arose against me, I caught him by his beard and struck him and killed him." What's David saying there? My dad gave me responsibility as a young man. He's saying, I already have been doing stuff like this, Saul. I've been killing bears, and I've been killing lions, and protecting my lamb. My parents gave me the chance to flourish as a young adult in their home, and they have trained me for my duties in the future. The duties his parents gave him prepared him for Goliath. Your servant has struck down both lions and bears, and this Philistine will be like one of those. In other words, David saw the connection between the training I got in my childhood, my faithfulness in small things, my faithfulness as an anonymous shepherd watching these sheep and protecting them from lions and bears. My faithfulness there has trained me for faithfulness today, and I can take on Goliath because the God who gave me the ability to fight the lions and the bears will help me fight Goliath as well. That's the biblical model. Teens are young adults. They're adults in apprenticeship years. We are training them for responsible independence. George Washington, similarly, he finished his education at the age of 15, and he began traveling around as a surveyor. When he was 16 years old, he got a job whose salary was $100,000 in today's dollars. When he was 21, he had acquired 2,300 acres of land. So our view that the teen brain is somehow irresponsible is historically false. If, in fact, the teen brain is now acting foolishly, it's because the environment has polluted it. It's because when you put a teen and all you give him is other teens and you give him the popular movies and the video games of today, he will not learn to be an adult because no one's expecting him to be an adult. When teens have training, when they have modeling, they rise to the level of expectations. Like I said earlier, high expectations lead to high performance, leads to confidence over time. Teens need to spend time with adults, and the time they spend with adults should be time that we take to train them into what it means to be an adult. 43% of Americans today are raised without a father. That's why we have the kind of disorder we have among young adults. The costs are catastrophic in terms of high school dropout rates, crime rates, depression, suicide rates, poverty rates. A lot of it stems from lack of modeling in the home. Okay, so what are adults like? What do we need to teach our teens? When our teens ask us, and we should be telling them, what does it mean to be an adult? Adults delay gratification. There's a basic principle in the book of Proverbs. Dominate your responsibilities or they will dominate you. Okay? That is a fundamental lesson. Every freshman needs to know that before they come to their freshman year of college. I have lost 25% of my freshmen for not knowing this. And they lose $10,000 in a whole year of their life. Because they didn't know that if they don't dominate their responsibilities, those responsibilities don't go away. The responsibilities dominate them. Proverbs 24, I passed by the field of a sluggard, by the vineyard of a man lacking sense. And behold, it was all overgrown with thorns. The ground was covered with nettles, and its stone wall was broken down. Okay? A little sleep, a little slumber, and poverty comes upon you like an armed man, right? So what I tell freshmen is, look, you goof around too much, you don't do your homework, that exam comes like an armed man, and you bomb that exam. The exam doesn't go away. You can't ignore your responsibilities and hope they're going to go away. They're going to come back and dominate you. Your choice is either dominate that work, dominate your responsibilities, dominate the sphere that God's given you to be responsible in, or those responsibilities will come up and dominate you. If I don't mow my lawn, the weeds grow like crazy. If I don't take care of my house, the house becomes run down. The pattern of this world is God calls us to be responsible stewards over our spheres, exercising godly authority, and being useful, or those spheres come on top of us. There's the whole verse. Anyone ever heard of the marshmallow experiment? No one's heard of the marshmallow experiment? You've heard of the Marshall Experiment? Okay, so the Marshall Experiment was a Stanford University psychologist, and he took the five-year-old kids, and he put a video camera in a room and left them a marshmallow and said, look, here's a marshmallow for you. You can eat it right now, or if you're willing to wait, I'm going to go step out for about 5-10 minutes, come back, I'm going to give you another marshmallow. You're going to have two marshmallows. Either one marshmallow now or two marshmallows in a few minutes. I'm leaving the room now. The video camera's watching them. What do? The kids start fidgeting, panicking. Some of them just grab it and eat it right away. Very small percentage of those kids were able to wait for 10 minutes. Very small percentage. But those kids, they followed them later on in life, and they found that they were academically superior, they were socially more confident, they were more articulate, they did their homework more often. They had a 210-point advantage on the SAT. Okay, SAT scores used to be at 1,600, now it's at 2,400. At 1,600 points, these students had a 210-point advantage on the SAT. So why is that? Because delayed gratification is so crucial to success. You got to be able to delay your passions. So if you have little kids at home, like I do, I teach them now is the chance to learn to manage and dominate and control your passions. Because if you don't, those same passions will get you in a lot of trouble someday. They'll get you in a little trouble now, but when you're 15 years old, you can get someone pregnant if you don't dominate your passions. So dominate those passions, because otherwise it'll get you in a lot of trouble. Okay, future orientation. I did this. Wait, what happened here? Okay, what happened? Just seeing if you're paying attention. All right. What happened? Yeah, this is where I am. This is where I am. Work and play. Work and play. Okay. The world's view is that work is a necessary evil. Okay. The problem with that, with work, is it cuts into my free time. This is how students tend to think. Schoolwork cuts into their free time, and we have the phrase, you know, TGIF. Thank God it's Friday. Live for the weekend. You have these bumper stickers that say, "I'd rather a bad day of fishing is better than a good day at work." All those kinds of things. And we have this idea in our culture that work is bad and play is good. And yeah, you have to work, but you really just want to play. And that's very foreign from the biblical model. God's view is that play is a refreshment to rejuvenate you to go back to work. So we have the phrase recreation, right? What does that word mean? Recreate is renewing your creative faculties. So recreation is supposed to restore you, supposed to refresh you, not for more recreation, but for more useful labor. God called us to work. Adam and Eve were commanded to work before the fall. Okay, work is ordained by God for us to imitate God and to steward our gifts and talents to make the world a better place. That's what Adam and Eve were told. We're to populate the earth and to subdue it. And that's still what we're told to do. We're told to do that for God's glory. Work is not a result of the fall. Work was what we were called to do before the fall. Those who lack meaningful work are often among the least happy in our society. When you look at suicide rates, especially among adult men, oftentimes it comes from dissatisfaction at their work. Work gives us a sense of satisfaction because God made us to be useful in society. So teach your teens to see work as intrinsically good and to understand that as students, studying is their work. It's their chance to glorify God by loving him with their minds and by developing their intellectual abilities for future faithfulness. Okay, that being said, recreation is definitely essential. I'm not advocating a sweatshop mentality. I'm not at all. I think it's good for kids to have some fun at college, to make good friendships, and to have times to go out and play. Recreation should be limited. You can't spend all your time recreating. Too much recreation lulls us from our responsibilities rather than refreshing us for them. Okay. Therefore, recreation should be intentional. We ought to choose it wisely. We shouldn't just react and passively just do it whenever. We shouldn't just play whenever anyone calls us to play. We should be intentional about it. We should be thoughtful about it. We need to choose it wisely. Recreation should empower us for our work, not distract us from our work. Okay. There are kinds of recreation that I knew in college that I couldn't handle. Video games, I get sucked into stuff very easily. So I knew if I play a video game for 15 minutes, I'll be playing it for 3 hours. So I just stopped playing them altogether. And I was much happier because I wasn't distracted by that. Now, some people can play for 15 minutes and that's it. That refreshes them for their labor. Fine. Do it. But for me, I knew I couldn't do it. So every teen has to learn who they are and what empowers them. For me, going jogging, playing tennis, working in the lawn for a little while refreshes me, and I feel restored, and then I can go back and do something else that I need to do. So you got to find what it is that works for you, but your recreation shouldn't distract you from work. It should empower you for work. Just because you can do something doesn't mean you should do it. Just because someone else does something doesn't mean you should do it. Even in our recreation, our attitude should be one of worship and thanksgiving, because recreation, like work, is a gift from God. Okay, talk about financial preparation now. Okay, teens and finances. College means they'll be spending opportunities more than they've ever had. Okay, when you're in college, the number of recreational opportunities and spending opportunities is really, really high. 2/3 of credit card holders that are college students don't pay their bills every month. They're carrying a balance on their credit card, which those of you who are parents, you know that's ridiculous, but they do it. So how do we help them? As they're growing up, give them increasing levels of financial responsibility. I mentioned the guy earlier who bought the mini disc. He learned from that how foolish to spend all your money on one piece of electronics. That was foolish, but he learned from it. As your kids grow older, what can you do to help them learn how to manage their limited amount of money? And maybe you think, my teen doesn't have any money. He doesn't need any money. Well, what can you do to help them? Maybe let's say that you're spending a few $100 a year on clothes for them. Could you allocate it to them in advance and say, hey, you're responsible for managing this money for the next 3 months to get whatever clothes you need. If you don't have enough money here, if you spend it all in 2 weeks, I'll help you find a job. And that way they learn to manage some amount of money. Money management is only learned by doing it. It can't be learned in theory. It has to be learned by doing it. And if they struggle now with small numbers, it's better for them to struggle now with small numbers and make small mistakes and then struggle with big numbers and make big mistakes. Natural consequences are a great teacher. There's verses in Psalms 119 that say, before I was afflicted, I went astray, but now I keep your word. So God uses pain to discipline us. So making mistakes with money is painful, but better to make it with small numbers than to make it with big numbers. And part of that is we have to let them reap natural consequences. We have to resist the temptation to come to their rescue when they make a mistake and to bail them out. That will keep them a child forever. The pain is necessary to train them. The pain must be allowed to do its work. If it isn't, they don't learn and end up making bigger mistakes when the stakes are higher. Okay, Daniel. I have a friend named Daniel. Excuse me. And he went to college and he got a credit card and he got in debt by a few $1,000s. And he didn't tell his parents. Somehow his parents were visiting him and they saw on his desk while he had stepped out and they saw on his desk some papers and they started looking at him and it was credit card bills, a few $1,000s of debt. And he came back in and they confronted him and said, how could you not come to us? And with this problem that you have interest rates and ballooning and it's terrible and you should have come to us. We would have helped you if you came to us. And he apologized and said, you're right, I should have came to you and told you about it. And I'm working on it. I'm going to solve it. And his dad pulled out his checkbook, wrote a check for the whole thing, gave it to him, said, here, it's done. And he said, wow, thank you, Dad. Thank you. That was amazing. Thank you. Grace, God's grace, right? 5 years later, he's in debt by five times the amount. And then his parents said, no, we're done. You go figure it out. And he's had to figure it out. He had to change his line of work to get more money. It's been very painful for him, but all of that was over-parenting. Parents that wouldn't let him reap what he sowed, wouldn't train him to do the right thing for himself. So it's very The stakes get higher as they get older. If they make a mistake now, yeah, it's frustrating to see them make a mistake now. But think how good it is for them. To get a little bit of pain now and to learn from it is the best way. Okay, God owns everything. We're just managers. They need to understand the money that they have is given to them by God to steward and to manage carefully. God gives us the power to gain wealth. Oops. Employment's about helping others flourish. Receiving money is a byproduct. Money doesn't fall from the sky. They need to learn that money comes from hard work. And teaching them that as soon as possible is the best way. We've chosen in our family, our kids don't get anything without working. They have to do some chores just to be just a part of being a member of our household. We all clean up after dinner. We all put our plates away. We all clean the plates in the sink. That's what everyone does. But besides that, our kids all have work that they have to do to earn money. And if they don't do those work, they don't get the money, and they can't get things they want to get. We want them to learn to associate work with money. And getting things that you want to get comes from your working for that money. That's how it works. That's the only way it works. We're raising a generation of teens who think that it comes out of the sky. A record number of college students believe the government should just pay for all their student loans. Just wipe it all out. Just wipe it away. As if that would really solve the problem. All that would happen is it'd be dumped in the taxpayers for the next generation. So we need to teach our kids responsibility that work brings money. They may not need the budgeting skills now, because they may not have much to buy now, but they need the skills eventually, so we might as well teach it to them now. Like I was saying earlier, maybe giving them, if you're going to spend a couple hundred dollars on their clothes, maybe let them manage it so they can learn how to manage some amount of money. The key is for them to learn the relationship between their earning, their spending, their saving, their giving. So giving, too, learning to tithe before they start making more money is crucial. If they're ever going to tithe when they make a lot of money, they better start tithing when they're making very little money. If they're ever going to save money when they have a lot of money, they better save money when they have very little money. So teaching them to save a percentage, give a percentage, spend a percentage, that's very important. Earning, spending, saving, giving, helping them as early as possible in life and all through the teen years, more and more and more, to earn money, to spend it, to save it, and to give it. It can be stuff that you do in their household, work that they do in their household, helping them, give them a reward for that, and teach them money leads to work leads to money. And now that you have this money, we're expecting you to be responsible to take care of your clothes, to take care of your books, to take care of your social outings with your friends, etc. Teaching them more and more, and then when they make mistakes, you pay for it. You learn from the mistake. All right. All right, college expenses. Okay, we'll spend about 5 minutes on this. Now we can do more in Q&A about college expenses. Housing prices vary, okay? Meal plans vary. Recreational expenses, limit recreational expenses there. So teaching them to manage their money now is so crucial because when they get to college, they'll be able to spend lots of money on recreation, and they got to learn now to delay gratification, to live within a budget, and to prioritize. Some other ways to save money there. We'll talk about that more in the Q&A. Earning money during college. A couple thoughts on that. Leveraging skills in college is crucial, okay? Can they teach piano? Can they fix computers? You can make a lot more money for things that you're good at than you can minimum wage jobs. That being said, academics are crucial. Don't encourage them not to work so much that they're not able to do their academics well. I had a student who had a 25 to 30 hour a week job at a really good job. He was a golf course as a caddy, country club kind of thing, getting big tips. He was working about 45 minutes from the campus. He'd come back late at night and be exhausted the next day in class. Didn't do his homework. He was getting low C's. Smart kid. But he kept telling me how much money he was making. I'm like, you're not making anywhere near the amount of money that you could make if you graduated and got a real job. But he was happy making, you know, $15,000 a year or something. He didn't realize that, you know, a few years from now, he's going to want to get married, have kids, and he's going to need to have more money than that. So just be careful not to work too much. That's a good rule to start off. If money's a big issue, I say focus earning on the summer and breaks when you're not in classes. That being said, one little hint, the FAFSA favors work-study and co-op money, okay? The FAFSA that you fill out every year penalizes student work beyond a certain amount at 50%. If you make more than $7,000 as a student, the FAFSA expects you to pay 50 cents on the dollar towards college thereafter. If you're getting student loan, if you're getting need-based aid, working a lot can end up costing you in financial aid. But if you do your work study hours and your co-op hours, those don't count at all towards your expected family contribution. If you don't know what that is, don't worry about it. You'll find out eventually when you do the FAFSA. Or ask me at the Q&A. We can talk about it. Student loans, just a couple of thoughts before we close out here. Student loans feel like gifts, okay? That's their problem with them. Students don't know, don't understand they have to pay it back with interest, so be careful about that. There's no collateral on student debt, right? You can't sell back your education. Like you can give back your house to the bank if you get repossessed. Student loans just follow you for life. They can't be discharged in bankruptcy. There's no collateral on them. They're not proportional to the risk level a student represents. This is really bizarre. You can be a computer science student at MIT and get the same loan at the same interest rate as an anthropology student at a third-rate college, even though we all know who's going to be more able to pay back their loans, right? But the bank, they get the same interest rate. What that means is that there's no disincentive to overborrow. So I've seen students that have $80,000 in debt in a humanities degree. They're going to go into elementary education and make $30,000 a year. And they're wondering how it's going to work. It's not going to work. So be careful with what you borrow. The average student loan balance at graduation is growing faster than the average starting salary. So what should you do about it? Avoid that first year. In the first year, a lot of students change majors. So you're not really sure what you're going to do yet sometimes. So avoid debt then. If needed, you can do that to save money. If you borrow, this is the big one, consider future earnings prospects. Don't borrow $80,000 if you're going to be an elementary education teacher. God is honored by elementary education teaching. Okay, you can be a teacher of 10-year-olds to the glory of God. That's a good line of work. But if you're going to go into that line of work, don't borrow this much money to get a job that's going to pay you this much money. Just be smart about it, okay? I'm not saying you can't pick a major that doesn't make a lot of money. Pick a major that's based on your calling, your skills, your gifts, your passions. That's where you should pick a major. But be smart about it, okay? If you're going to pick a major that's not going to lead to a high-paying career, don't borrow a ton of money, okay? And then we'll do a Q&A afterwards, so thank you.